His eyes were open and rolled back. Damn it. Target's dead. Dom had his gun back in the fight and pointed toward the doorway. Yep. Jack connected with Beery. Gavin, are you still with us? There was no reply. Gavin, do you copy? Nothing. Jack shouted now. If you can hear me, we've got squirters coming your way. Do not come in this building. He climbed to his feet. Shouting to his cousin, he said, Get Scholar's laptop! And then took off, leaping over the dead bodies in front of him on his way out the door. Gavin was stuck in a slow-moving elevator in the office building on Baranova Street, and he realized he'd lost his mobile connection with the guys right at the worst possible time. It occurred to him too late that he should have taken the stairs. As well as being a mobile phone dead zone, the elevator descended at a glacial pace. Shit, 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 he shouted at himself. When he finally got down to street level, he ran outside, then down the sidewalk toward Skala's Christianova Street apartment building. While he ran, he looked down at his phone and redialed into the conference call to reestablish his connection with Jack and Dom. If they were still alive, that was. The gunfire he'd heard through his earpiece before he lost comms had been extraordinary. It sounded like a war was being fought in the building across the street. As soon as he heard the call answered, he looked up and saw an Asian man running out of Scholar's building, directly across the street from him. Gavin stopped in his tracks and watched him. The Asian shielded a pistol inside his coat. Several other people ran out of the building all around the armed man, unaware this was one of the people responsible for all the gunfire that had them running for their lives. Gavin said, Jack? Dom? Jack's breathless response caused Gavin to blow out a sigh of relief. We're here. Do not approach the building. There is at least one squirter heading down toward the lobby. Is a squirter a bad guy running away? Yes. I'm watching him now. He's getting into a gray van with a man behind the wheel. They're leaving the scene. Just let them go. We'll be down in 30 seconds. You need to get us packed up and ready to get the fuck out of here. Gavin spun around, began running back to the office building. I'm on it. The team had their hindsight broken down, packed up, and loaded into the Mercedes in 10 minutes flat, while Jack pulled the vehicle out of the underground parking garage. Doing his best to keep from burning rubber to get out of the neighborhood, Dom called Adara from the back seat. She answered on the first ring. Yes. Dom knew the encryption on his phone was good, so he had no worries about watching what he said. You aren't going to believe this. You need another in extremis departure. It's becoming a thing, isn't it? Any wounded? Negative. We're okay, but we've got to get out of here. What's the opposition? North Korean. I don't know anything more than that, and I doubt they know who we are. But the local police are going to be looking for two guys matching the description of Jack and I as soon as they start taking statements at the crime scene. Crime scene? Adara asked. One dead local. Our target. 4 dead foreign nationals. North Koreans. Jesus, Dom. Shit got crazy. Just get here and I'll get you out of the country. Roger that. Dom ended the call and slipped the phone back in his pocket. Ryan called out from behind the wheel. What did Sherman say? She said she'll be ready. Gavin spoke up for the first time. Guys, I'm so sorry. He explained what happened with the arrival of the building superintendent. Dom wasn't in the mood to listen. He just closed his eyes and leaned his head back. But Jack paid attention. When Beery had explained himself, Jack said, If you would let us know you were leaving your overwatch, we could have been ready, Gavin. You see that, don't you? Gavin said, Yeah, I see. It happened so fast. I didn't want to alarm you. Dom kept his eyes closed and his head back, but he said, You know what really alarmed me? The half dozen bastards shooting at me. I'm sorry, Gavin repeated. The remainder of the drive to the airport passed in silence. Chapter 26. The flight from Chicago O'Hare to Reagan National was only 90 minutes in duration, but 35-year-old CIA officer Adam Yao climbed up the jetway looking like he'd traveled halfway around the planet. And with good reason. This flight to D.C. was the end of nearly 24 hours of commercial air travel for Yao that began on the other side of the world and had left his body clock utterly confused. Although it was mid-morning now, Adam's brain thought it was somewhere around midnight. After sleeping poorly in coach, as well as traveling across nearly half the world's time zones, he struggled with the task of putting one foot in front of the other, and he noticed he was leaning onto his carry-on as he walked, for balance. Adam Yao's flight from Singapore to D.C. was a three-legged odyssey that took him through Tokyo and Chicago before depositing him bleary-eyed and achy here at Reagan National. It was just 9:30 a.m. He'd love nothing more than to check into a hotel for a few hours' rest before making an appearance at work. But his instructions were to get himself to McLean, Virginia, as soon as possible. He planned on renting a car, but as soon as he turned his phone on after touchdown, he received word a driver was outside in the arrivals area. He had no checked luggage, rare for a man flying halfway around the globe, so he stepped out into the bright morning and found a black Lincoln Navigator waiting for him. Adam was an operations officer with the Central Intelligence Agency, but he was no desk-riding embassy spook with diplomatic cover. He'd spent a good portion of his young career working in Hong Kong under non-official cover, meaning he worked out in the shadows. After Hong Kong, he was transferred back to Langley for several months of desk work, but the very week he was cleared to return to NOC status, he was wheels up for Singapore, desperate to leave the boring bureaucracy of federal government employment behind and get back to what he loved to do. Work in the shadows. While the home office of Yao's employer, the Central Intelligence Agency, was here in McLean, CIA was not his destination this morning. Instead, he was driven to Liberty Crossing, a gated government building complex not far away from Langley HQ. There are two main buildings at the Liberty Crossing property off Lewinsville Road. They are virtually identical, and they are referred to by those in government as LX1 and LX2. LX1 houses the National Counterterrorism Center, and LX2 is the home of ODNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Though the CIA was Yao's employer, ODNI was the umbrella organization over all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, and this made ODNI Yao's masters as well. His identification was checked at the front gate. He was brought into the building and checked again. His phone was placed in a tiny locker, he was scanned and wanded, and after all these measures, measures that he had endured countless times in his decade with a top-secret clearance, he was ushered into an office on the third floor of the building. He waited alone for a moment. There was coffee in front of him, but he'd had so much this morning already on the flight over from Chicago that his stomach burned, so he didn't touch it. Adam did not have a clue why he had been recalled to the United States, and he certainly did not know why he was here at LX2 instead of the CIA building just a 10-minute drive away. He was pretty good at guessing when things like this happened, but at the moment he was more tired than curious, so he just sat there. Until a side door to the conference room opened. When it did, Adam glanced up. Then he immediately launched to his feet. Entering the room alone was Brian Calhoun, the CIA's Director of National Clandestine Service. Calhoun was the head spy at the agency, nearly at the top of the pecking order, and so many rungs above Adam Yao, he'd need a pen and a sheet of paper to figure out just how many positions separated them. He'd never met Calhoun, outside a brief handshake during a debrief last year. But Yao was a fan, and now he wished he'd bothered to check the knot of his tie in the bathroom. He imagined he looked like hell, and Adam Yao was a young man who liked to make a good impression with his appearance. Adam chanced to look behind the director of NCS as he entered, thinking for sure Calhoun would be followed by a gaggle of underlings. But instead, Calhoun shut the side door himself and crossed the conference room with a smile. Son, that flight was a bitch, wasn't it? Oh, I'm fine, sir. Then you're a better man than me. Singapore to D.C. always kicks my ass. Australia's worse, but not much. Adam said, I managed some sleep along the way. I'm good to go, sir. It wasn't true, but he assumed Calhoun wasn't here to listen to him complain about air travel. Take a seat. Both men sat down at the large table. I talked to your control officers on the fifth floor. I've read pretty much every report you've filed for the last 9 months. You were doing a hell of a job. Thank you, sir. Adam couldn't help it. His mind was spinning, trying to figure out what this was all about. A promotion? That would have surprised him. He had not been at his new assignment for long at all. Unless someone above him he didn't know had moved on, it didn't seem likely they'd pull Adam out of NOC work to move him back to Langley. And unless he was being promoted to station chief, a half dozen steps above his level now, then Brian Calhoun wouldn't be involved in the promotion. That meant, to Adam, that Calhoun must be here because of a new operation. A good NOC, no matter how deep he is in his cover, and no matter what it is he is doing, knew he could be moved at any time. But again, Adam thought to himself, the damn head of the service shouldn't be the guy doling out the op orders. Your work in Singapore is going nicely so far, and what you did in Hong Kong was nothing short of magnificent. Thank you very much, Adam said. But we rushed you back home like this because we have a new opportunity, and we think you might be just the man for the job. A new operation? Potentially, yes. Okay, Adam said, a hint of confusion bleeding through into his voice. Calhoun cocked his head. Something wrong? Adam smiled apologetically and said, You can understand my confusion, sir. Normally my control officer, or maybe a section head, would brief me. I find it more than surprising that someone like yourself is talking to me about a new assignment. Now it was Calhoun's turn to smile. Yao? You ain't seen nothing yet. As if on cue, the same side door opened, and Mary Pat Foley, the Director of National Intelligence, entered the room. Adam rose to his feet quickly, and Calhoun did the same. Yao never saw top-level IC execs without three or four attendants and subordinates. It was confusing to him to see both Calhoun and Foley unaccompanied. Good morning, Adam. Madam Director? I heard you flew in from Singapore. Yes, ma'am. And then we rushed you here without a shower? Adam reddened with embarrassment. Is it that obvious? Mary Pat smiled without responding. Then she, Calhoun, and Yao sat at the conference table. How far did we get? She asked Calhoun. He's still in the what-the-hell-is-going-on phase. Foley laughed. Unfortunately, Adam, some government servants spend their entire career in that phase. Not you, though. I'll explain everything. First, I assume Brian already gave you the whole obligatory we love your work spiel? Yes, ma'am. Then I will cut to the chase. Adam, what do you know about the mining sector in China? Adam raised his eyebrows. Surprised by the question for a few reasons, but at least, as far as the topic was concerned, he found himself on firm ground. Quite a bit. When I was working undercover in Hong Kong as a corporate investigations consultant, I had a lot of issues with two of China's six state-owned mining concerns, Chinalco and Minmetals. They were stealing technology from Western firms, and I worked to bring these transgressions to light. And what about rare earth element mining in particular? He was still off kilter because he was in an Audnik conference room with the top intelligence official in the U.S. government, But now he was more intrigued by this mysterious operation than he was by the manner it was being presented to him. That's huge over in China. They are the player in the industry, controlling over 90% of the world's extraction and supply. Go on, Mary Pat said. Adam smiled. If this was a test, he was about to nail it. There are 17 rare earth minerals, and they all occur together, so while a rare earth deposit might have a higher relative proportion of one of the minerals as opposed to another, a rare earth mine extracts all of the minerals together as ore and then sends it off to be processed. Rare earths are divided into two categories, light and heavy. China extracts the majority of the world's rare earth minerals for a number of reasons. Low labor costs and negligible environment standards for a process that is very hard on the environment allow them to price the goods cheaply. But the main reason for China's supply-side dominance is the discovery of massive mineral deposits. They simply have more of the stuff than anyone else. Having said that, they also use more of it than anyone else. China ran into trouble due to its explosive growth. Its manufacturing sector began using more of the rare earths, just as its demand for other commodities increased, and this left less available to export, increasing the cost of the commodity. Australia has been increasing its mining in the past few years, as has the U.S., but they are whistling in the wind in this industry. Why do you say that? China will always be at a competitive advantage with the West. They have absurdly low labor costs. Their mines operate on government land without paying for the privilege. There are virtually no environmental regs for them there. We have some rare earth mining in the West, but we pay a lot more to get the commodity out of the ground and processed than the Chinese ever will. Calhoun slapped Yao on his back, startling him. He looked to Mary Pat. I told you Yao would know his stuff. Adam clarified, I know a good bit about the Chinese rare earth operations, the major players and the regions where they mine the ore. And I understand the technique of the mining and the ore processing in a general sense, but I sure couldn't operate a gas scrubber at a rare earth mine or anything like that. Mary Pat said, We don't need you with a pick down in a shaft, but we were hoping you would already possess some knowledge about the industry. That I do, Adam said. He was humble about a lot of things, but he had been sitting in China, Hong Kong, and then Singapore for the past few years, totally engrossed in the Chinese economy. He had all the confidence in the world about his deep knowledge of it. Mary Pat then asked, And what about the illegal rare earth mining industry in China? Sure, he said, a little less confidently. Gangster mines. Illegal private corporations run by Chinese organized crime have big REM mines in Inner Mongolia as well as other places. They are successful because local and regional governments benefit from them. The gangsters pay bribes and such. He chuckled. And if you think the government-run mines fall short of environmental standards, the gangster miners are a whole lot worse. Foley turned to Calhoun and nodded. Adam realized he'd passed some sort of a test, but he wasn't sure what that had earned him. Calhoun leaned forward on his elbows. We have one hell of a problem, and we have one hell of an opportunity. You want to put me into a Chinese mine? Adam knew the Chinese government had tried to kill him once in Hong Kong. They got close. So close it was clear an intelligence breach had occurred that gave them information about Yao and his actions. He wasn't crazy about working in China, and he felt awkward about the fact it looked like he'd have to remind these two in front of him of his unique situation. But Calhoun shook his head and said, No, we'd need you to go into China for a very short time to establish your cover, but we're confident we have a way to make that happen. Your ultimate destination would instead be somewhere else. Adam relaxed a little, but he was careful not to show it. Okay. Where do you need me to go? Mary Pat took over. Your file says you speak Korean. Just fair. I spent a semester in high school as an exchange student in Seoul. Then I returned for a semester of college, studied the language in school, and took a night class while doing NOC work in HK. The two intelligence executives nodded at the young officer. They knew all this already. Adam asked the next question with some concern. We are talking about me going into South Korea, correct? When the answer did not immediately come from either Foley or Calhoun, Adam just muttered, You gotta be kidding. Mary Pat answered now. What would you say if I told you we have a way to get you into North Korea? I would respectfully ask you to provide a little more information. The room was tense, but Foley laughed. That is understandable. Nearly 2 years ago, Chinese geologists and miners working in the DPRK found deposits in the mountains of the Chongzhou region near their northern border with China. They dug test shafts and confirmed the find, then began establishing the infrastructure for extraction. Adam had heard something about this, but it had never been on his radar enough to look into it more closely. Mary Pat said, Then about a year ago, Choi Ji-hoon threw the Chinese mining concern out of his country. Why? We don't know. Some contractual issue, perhaps? What we do know is his new minister of mining, a man named Huang, has recently allowed a group of illegal Chinese mining industry personnel into Chongzhou to work at the mine. Clearly, he's smart enough to know DPRK can't extract the rare earths without expert help. The gangster miners are crucial to his operation. Sounds prudent. This gangster mining company is very experienced and well-organized, but they have specialized in extraction, not processing. The North Koreans have to process the ore themselves now. They can't very well hand it off to the Chinese after canceling the Chinese contract. So the illegal operation has established a front company in Shanghai for the sole purpose of obtaining processing technology and brain power from abroad. She paused. Are you with me so far? Yao just nodded, urging her on. This company has been in contact with a Chinese national working at a rare earth mineral mine in California. We only found out about it because we've had a surveillance package on the man for some time. Initially, we thought the man was working for Chinese intelligence. He is not. Quite the opposite, actually. He is a gangster miner himself who managed to get hired in the U.S. to headhunt talent at Newcorp, the American mining concern. We have the ability to intercept communications between the gangster mining company and their agent in California. We know what the Chongzhou rare earth processing plant needs as far as specialized labor. They're rushing to find the right people for the jobs, because in just 2 weeks they will be sending another group into North Korea to work at the mine and the processing plant. Our plan is to notify the gangster miners that he has recruited a Chinese-American with knowledge of a critical piece of technology used in rare earth ore processing. That man, our man, will then fly to Shanghai to join the gangster miners, and from there go into Pyongyang along with the rest of the Chinese. He will go to Chongzhou under DPRK government control and work at the mine. Yao was astonished. This was a massive operation. And report back to the U.S. some way? Calhoun answered this one. That's right. Science and technology has some communications equipment that can go into DPRK. They say it is undetectable. Adam kept an impassive face. But he couldn't help but think the eggheads at S&T wouldn't be stood in front of a wall and shot if their undetectable device was somehow detected in the DPRK. If Adam went into North Korea, that fate would fall to him. He muttered an unenergetic, Great. Mary Pat picked up on his doubt. The North Koreans aren't just allowing miners and processors into the country. They are also trying to get equipment in. The communications system will not travel with our asset. It will be embedded in a computer that our asset will have access to at the mine. We've learned a shipment of computers will be sent from Bulgaria to North Korea next week. We'll have one of the machines altered with the hidden communications equipment. As long as our asset isn't caught communicating with the device red-handed, our asset will be free and clear on this operation. Yes, ma'am. I understand. He noted that Mary Pat was speaking in general terms, still referring to the person going into North Korea as our asset. Clearly she wanted him to agree to go, but she wasn't assuming anything yet, and this Adam appreciated. He asked, "What specific intelligence are you trying to get from an asset in the Chungju mine?" Mary Pat replied, "Satellites aren't telling us what we need to know. Is there equipment in the mine in violation of sanctions? Are there personnel from other countries there? Experts? Specialists? How soon till that mine is generating revenue for the DPRK?" "May I ask how many other CIA officers are operating inside North Korea?" Mary Pat shook her head. "I can't give you that information. I can only tell you that you will be working without a network in country." Adam assumed as much. If he went into the DPRK, he would be on his own. But this wasn't the only thing bothering him. "I have to ask, is this really that big an issue, considering all the other problems we have with North Korea? I mean, they are involved in illegal mining in violation of sanctions. But if you can get me in the country, shouldn't I be trying to get a look at something more important than mining?" Mary Pat said, "If possible, yes, you should. We see it as an incredible coincidence, and hopefully one we can capitalize on, that in a nation some 46,000 square miles in size, the Chungju mine happens to be located only 24 miles away from Sohae's satellite launching station. Sohae is where they launch their ICBMs." "That is a coincidence that probably seems a bit easier to capitalize on while we're sitting here in Virginia. In country, 24 miles might seem like a long way." She smiled. "Very true. And we're not sending you there because of Sohae." Mary Pat shook her head. "President Ryan has dictated that this mine at Chungju represents a critical intelligence need of the United States." That sounded to Adam like hyperbole. He didn't know Mary Pat Foley personally, but he knew that her reputation was of a supremely level-headed individual. "What makes it a critical need?" "Because estimates put the capacity under those mountains at 213 million tons of heavy rare earth minerals, a value approaching, depending on market conditions, $12 trillion. Adam reached out with both hands and took hold of the conference table. $12 trillion? That can't be possible, can it?" "It can. Is your imagination big enough to consider what all Pyongyang could buy with $12 trillion? Adam nodded slowly. "They could buy nukes, ballistic missiles, every bit of armament made by the Russians or the Chinese. They could buy technology and intellectual capital." Mary Pat leaned over the table. "They can buy all that, but they can also buy something more important. Friends." "Friends?" "Votes in the UN. States that would go against official sanctions. Trading partners they can't even dream of now. With that much money on the table, many nations who seem so perfectly resolute now in their insistence they won't work with a rogue regime would suddenly find some flexibility in the issue." "Right." Mary Pat added, "And someone outside of North Korea is already paying them for the right to extract minerals there. A lot of money. These hard currency payments are being converted into an expansion of North Korea's missile program. The rocket tubes captured off the coast of North Korea last week were purchased with this money, and we assume there is a lot more money and a lot more proliferation going on out there that we don't know about. Calhoun said, "You see why this Chongju mine represents a clear and present danger to the United States, don't you?" Adam's answer was barely audible. He was still in awe. "I get it," he said. "North Korea with hard currency is a bad thing." Mary Pat nodded and said, "Now, back to you. If you accept this operation, you need to understand something. This is not going to be a career maker for you, simply because you don't need it. What you did in HK last year was more than enough to make your career. Your trip to North Korea is going to be 100% risk for not much reward." Adam shrugged. "Maybe everybody says this, Director Foley, but I'm not looking for advancement. I'm looking for a challenge." She eyed him for a moment, then looked away. "My husband and I loved what we did. There are 1,000 frustrations and 1,000,000 levels of bullshit with this job, but at its core, it can be one hell of a thrill, can't it?" Adam grinned. "Nothing like it." Calhoun nodded silently. Mary Pat said, "We think our plan to get you in, established, and reporting back is solid. I just need to know if you will volunteer to go." "So?" Adam didn't hesitate. "So, let's do this." Mary Pat said, "Good. But remember, they don't call it gangster mining without reason. You will be in danger from the people you were around the moment you get off the airplane in Shanghai." "I understand. Time is critical, so we'll need to get you up to speed very quickly. After a few days here, you will go to California to learn the skills you need to backstop your legend. You have today to rest up, and we'll start tomorrow prepping you." The adrenaline coursing through Adam Yao dictated the next words out of his mouth. "I can start right now." Mary Pat shook her head. "Nope. Your national intelligence director is directing you to a hotel to sleep and take a shower. You'll thank me in the morning. We'll have someone drive you and then bring you some food, toiletries, and a change of gear. Tomorrow morning, CIA will pick you up and begin a quick workup of your legend before you're off to California." "Yes, ma'am," he said. Chapter 27 By the time Ryan, Caruso, and Beery returned to Alexandria, Virginia from their mission in the Czech Republic, the rest of the campus operational staff had relocated to New York City to begin looking into the operation of Duke Sharps. Dom and Jack would have loved to have joined their cohorts in Manhattan, not just so they could get to the bottom of the operation that had nearly cost them their lives, but also to avoid going back into their office and facing Jerry Hendley. They had briefed Jerry over the sat phone during the long flight back to the States, and to say he was displeased was an understatement. Jerry wasn't a field operative himself, so normally he demurred and left the hot wash aspect of the after-action reports to John Clark. But when he learned IT Director Gavin Beery had been given an overwatch role during a covert breach, and Beery's failure to warn the team about an approaching threat had resulted in the near death of 2 of his operators, the death of the target, and the deaths of somewhere to the tune of 6 North Korean aggressors, all in the middle of a major European city, Jerry had told his 2 operators that as soon as their plane landed, they needed to get themselves down from Baltimore and into Hendley Associates, and by then, they better have some sort of an explanation. Dom didn't feel like he and Jack were at fault. As far as he was concerned, Gavin was the one who screwed up, and Gavin should have taken most of the heat that was now focused on him and his cousin. But Jack understood Gavin couldn't be blamed for not being a trained field operative. Just as Dom wouldn't get grief from Hendley for failing to hack into an opposition computer server, Beery got a pass for his inability to execute his forced role in a covert entry. But Gavin had not excused himself. Far from it. He was nearly beside himself with shame for his mistake. By the end of the flight, Dom had gotten to the point where he was no longer furious with the IT director, and Jack had told Gavin all along that the blame lay at his own feet, not Gavin's. But the big man remained inconsolable. This morning, while Dom and Jack were in Jerry's office trying to explain what the hell had happened in Prague, Gavin sat sullenly at his desk, though he was working. He'd taken Carl Scala's laptop, retrieved in Prague by Dom and Jack, and he did a deep search of deleted files on the hard drive. It didn't take him long to find what he was looking for. 5 images sent to Scala 3 weeks earlier, just 1 week before Colin Hazelton died in Vietnam. There was no question that these were the 5 pictures used for the documents. They were typical passport pictures of 4 men and 1 woman, and they'd arrived at the right time. So Gavin uploaded the images into his facial recognition application, and now the software ran on the machine in front of him. While Gavin sat and sulked, the images were in the process of being measured hundreds of ways, from the width, height, depth, and shape of the periocular region of the face, to the precise spatial relationship between the nose and the upper lip. The tabulated scores of each of the measurements were added together to create a numerical value for each face, which was then compared with millions of images of faces culled from virtually every source on the Internet, as well as the databases of the 5 Eyes intelligence agencies of the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, New Zealand, and Australia. Any image with a significantly different numerical value from the unknown images was instantly discarded by the computer, but those close in value were then compared more carefully. The computer checked through the individual measurements for additional matches. If the ears were the same distance from the nose, the computer went on to the periocular depth. If that was similar to the unknown image, then the score measuring shape of the jawline was compared. If that panned out, then the computer moved on to the shape of the lips. In this fashion, millions of images were compared with the unknown image. The process took some time, of course. Although all faces are different, even identical twins have differing measurements when evaluated as precisely as the facial recognition software did. Many faces of people who do not appear to the naked eye to be that similar actually have value scores that are nearly alike. Gavin expected it would be another few hours before he knew if he would be able to put names to any of the 5 faces from Scala's computer. While Gavin's monitor spun images faster than a slot machine, he leaned forward with his face between his elbows. He felt like shit. There was no getting around the mistake he made in Prague. Jack Jr., to his credit, had tried to tell Gavin it wasn't his fault. But Gavin knew he'd blown it. His own actions, or inactions, had led to the death of an important witness and nearly caused the death of his 2 friends and colleagues. Gavin Beery had no idea how he would ever redeem himself for his error. Just then, a computerized female voice startled him. Match found. Gavin lifted his head and stared at his machine in astonishment. He couldn't believe an identity had been determined so quickly. It was the woman, the redhead who looked to be in her mid-40s. The monitor displayed the image used in her passport photo in the Czech Republic on one side of the screen, and on the other was another picture of her. Here she stood at a lectern. Apparently she was speaking to an audience. Several other photos, all identified by the facial recog software as the same woman, were tiled under this photo. Gavin saw why the software identified the redhead so quickly. She was apparently quite prominent in her field, and there were a lot of images of her on the Internet. He worked another few minutes to double-check the woman's name and biography with his own Internet search, then snatched up his phone's receiver and dialed Jerry's extension. He supposed this could wait until Jerry's meeting with Dom and Jack broke up, but Gavin thought it possible this bit of good news just might help the 2 cousins out of their predicament. Hendley answered on the first ring. "Yeah, Gavin?" He sounded annoyed, and Gavin read that to mean he was annoyed not just at the two young men sitting in front of him, but also at the man on the other end of the line. Gavin said, "Sorry to bother you, Jerry, but we have a match on a face we got from Carl Scala." Hendley sighed. "Okay, you'd better come up." Gavin swallowed. He wanted to take some of the heat off the cousins, but he didn't want to go up there and sit with them while they got yelled at. Sure. I'm on the way." A few minutes later, Gavin entered Hendley's office and found Dom and Jack sitting quietly in front of the ex-senator's desk. Hendley sat in his chair behind the desk, but unusual for him, he did not stand when Gavin came in. An empty chair sat next to Jack. Jerry said, "Come in, shut the door, and tell us what you've got." Gavin sat down. "I have an ID on the red-headed woman. The software is still trying to identify the other four images." Jerry Hendley waited for a moment. Then he sighed, a little irritated. "Well, who is she?" "Oh, sorry. Her name is Dr. Helen Powers. She's Australian, a geologist." Jack and Dom stared at each other. A geologist? They had been expecting the five mystery travelers to be nuclear engineers or rocket scientists. Gavin said, "She's a big deal in Australian geology, apparently. Lots of pictures of her at conferences and such. She's involved in the search for rare earth mineral deposits, mostly in the Australian outback." Dom said the thing the others were thinking. Why the hell are all these people getting killed over geology? Gavin left a minute later, and Jerry turned his attention back to the two men in front of him. "Jack, Dominic, Prague was a disaster. You are lucky to have survived, and any chance that that target of yours might have been able to pass on more intelligence about whatever the North Koreans are planning was lost when he was killed. The fact that the last two men that the campus has gone into the field to watch over have both turned up dead within hours of our arrival makes me wonder if we need to reevaluate what the hell we are doing." Jack and Dom just nodded. They'd been doing a lot of that over the past hour. Now wasn't the time to argue with the director of the campus. But even taking that into consideration, Jack felt like he needed to get Jerry on another topic. Jack said, "I guess this is not the time to ask, but I was wondering if there was any chance we could go up and support Clark's operation in New York. He's thin up there with just three guys." Jerry turned to Caruso. "Dom, I want you up there by this evening." Dominic sat up, surprised. Jerry said, "You are John Clark's subordinate. Don't go thinking for yourself on this one. Let John use you for surveillance." Dom was too happy to be offended. He had pictured himself sitting at his desk for the next few months while Clark and the others got to delve into this mystery in the Big Apple, so he was thrilled to get the chance to go. He said, "You've got it, Jerry." Jack raised an eyebrow. Was he going to be punished with desk duty? Jerry said, "And as for you, Jack, that was your operation in Prague. There was a poor result, so you take the brunt of the heat. Let's put you at your desk to remember what it's like to do straight analytical work for a while. Go to work on Dr. Helen Powers. Find out what the hell is going on involving mines that is getting people murdered on multiple continents." "Okay, Jerry," Jack said. He and his cousin stood to leave soon after. Out in the hallway, Dom put his hand on Jack's shoulder. "Not fair, cuz. I pushed you to do the sneak and peek on Scala's place." Ryan shrugged. "Jerry's putting both of us where we need to go right now. You go up there and get some dirt on Sharps. I'll stay here and figure out what the next piece to this puzzle is." Chapter 28 Lieutenant General Ri Tae-jin of the Reconnaissance General Bureau was surprised with the incredible speed at which his plan was taking shape. Normally, when a scheme formed at anything more than a snail's pace, he was satisfied. So hard was the intelligence game when it came to real-world application. But his new operation, the computer had chosen the code name Fire Axe, might have been progressing too fast for its own good. Fire Axe, if successful, would culminate with the assassination of the President of the United States, and the general had more concerns than good feelings about its prospects. He wondered if he was rushing into a maelstrom of his own making. He hoped the quick development of Fire Axe was simply fortune intervening, and that his good fortune would continue. And as each step of the operation came and went with a positive outcome, he became, if not more confident, at least less quick to dismiss the entire prospect of the affair. Ri had lost full confidence in Choi Ji-hoon, but he did have to admit that Dae Won-soo was absolutely right in his analysis. Killing Jack Ryan would almost unquestionably lead to success in his other quest, that to obtain a working mid-range ICBM. He allowed himself to entertain thoughts of the post-Ryan world, where North Korea had the ability to strike the United States or Western Europe with a plutonium missile. He didn't consider actually seeing the ICBM put to use in this task. No, that would mean the certain death of everyone in North Korea when the USA retaliated. But if North Korea possessed the missile and threatened to use it, the fortunes of his nation would be starkly and unquestioningly improved. And this was part of the fuel that spurred him forward. The other part, the larger part, was the same fuel that propelled his quest for the ICBM, his own self-preservation. He did not have the luxury to shelve Fire Axe if it did not pan out perfectly, because he knew his next meeting with Choi, were he to balk at the assassination attempt, would only lead to his own death. The evening after his meeting with Choi at his Kangdong-gun property, he had organized an emergency conference with his top lieutenants, and he tasked them to work on the plan. Almost immediately there was a framework. In truth, the assassination of world leaders was a constant theoretical and occasional real-world exercise at RGB, and several proposals were drawn up every month, so the infrastructure was already in place. And there were few state actors on Earth more experienced in international crime than North Korea. Even though North Korea was known as being a nation cut off from the rest of the world, its intelligence was, in fact, uniquely well-positioned for a conspiracy on a global scale. Ri personally worked with top agents of many regimes, either buying or selling weapons, and sending his officers and agents into other nations to train their officers and agents in the art of enhanced interrogation techniques. And the RGB was also deeply involved with most all of the major criminal syndicates in the world. They made millions of dollars every year in the drug trade, producing and selling methamphetamine, mostly to European crime families or Mexican drug cartels. They printed and trafficked counterfeit hard currency and bought and sold illegal weapons of all classification. Ri and his staff knew the players who could make Fire Axe a reality. There was no question that he could put an assassin with a network in the same place as the American president. But to do it with no comebacks on North Korea was another matter entirely. Ri and his officers looked at all Ryan's scheduled foreign travel over the next few months. He'd be in Europe on two separate trips, once in Berlin at a trade conference, and once in Poland for another meeting of NATO leadership. He would also be in Mexico City in 2.5 weeks' time for a 2-day official visit. And later he would fly to Buenos Aires for 2 more days of meetings and travel. Europe was an enticing possibility for the simple matter that relations between the United States and Russia were terrible at the moment. Ri knew the Russian president, Valery Volodin, wanted Jack Ryan dead, And more important, he knew the Americans knew it. But fingering Russia would be all but impossible. Yes, he had contacts in Moscow, but mostly with small computer hacking organizations, or with Rosaboron Export, the nation's state-owned arms trader. He'd dealt in drugs with a Russian bratva, but he didn't have the influence over them he needed to perpetrate such a crime. Ree liked Mexico more. The timeline was short, but the atmospherics were perfect. 6 months earlier, one of the larger and more violent Mexican drug cartels lost its leader, Antonio Maldonado, in a shootout with federal police in Acapulco. The Guerrero-based Maldonado cartel had been reeling ever since, and now that the leader's younger brother, Santiago Maldonado, had been put in charge, they had shown themselves to be even more volatile, more reactionary than before. It had been rumored at the time of the killing that the Mexican authorities had found Antonio Maldonado only through the technical help they received from a group of American military communication specialists. The unit, known informally as the Activity, had been instrumental in locating Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar more than 20 years earlier, and they had been in and out of South America ever since, pinch-hitting for friendly nations in the war on drugs. Neither the U.S. nor Mexico had acknowledged the fact American military advisers were on the ground in Acapulco when Antonio Maldonado was cut down in a fusillade of carbine fire, but his brother, the Mercurial Santiago, had vowed revenge. Ree contacted his non-official cover officers in Mexico who worked with the Maldonado cartel, and they confirmed they thought it likely he could be persuaded to support an assassination attempt on the American president. Santiago was a drug-addled, nihilistic maniac, according to Ree's officers, and if Santiago harbored any concerns for his own self-preservation, he didn't show them. Moreover, he would have absolutely no qualms about sending his own cult-like followers to a slaughter if there was the chance to exact retribution for the man responsible for his brother's death. But the North Koreans quickly realized that although Maldonado had men and guns, his force was unskilled, and he had no way to assassinate the President of the United States. General Ree decided that the Mexican cartel could, however, still play a crucial role in the operation, because Ree knew where to find the killer. He looked to another piece of the puzzle after he fleshed out the idea he had relayed to the Daewon Su. The general himself spoke with a close confidant who formerly was the head of Syria's General Security Directorate, but had gone into hiding in North Africa during the war. Ree let the man know he was looking for someone who could work independently and be involved in a high-level assassination. The Syrian did not ask about the target, since he knew Ree would not tell him. Instead, he accepted a finder's fee to give Ree the contact information for a single bomb-maker, a man who, so said the Syrian, was both abundantly talented and looking for a way out of his present circumstance. Ree was surprised to see the contact was not Syrian himself. He was Iranian, but he worked independently of Tehran. In fact, he'd freelanced as a bomb maker for the last few years. Ree contacted the Syrian government and asked for the opportunity to hire the man for some training in North Korea. They were open to the idea, and they arranged a meeting. Adil Zarif lived in a Syrian intelligence safe house in Damascus, the city in which the Iranian had been living for more than 3 years. There was a price on his head by both Hezbollah and the Free Syrian Army rebels, and rumors were he was on an American presidential kill list as well. Hezbollah wanted him dead for leaving their fold and turning freelance. The FSA wanted him dead for killing hundreds of their fighters in the Civil War, and American drones combed the world for him because of the years he spent in Iraq, training insurgents in his specialty, the improvised explosive device. Zarif disagreed with the term, To him, there was nothing improvised about his explosive devices. He had studied electrical engineering in Tehran before becoming a Hezbollah operative. In the 90s, he'd wired bombs for Hezbollah and built bomb vests for Palestinian terrorists in southern Lebanon. When the war came to Iraq, he was already in the country, already working with the Shiite militias, and Hezbollah pulled him back home for further training and study of tactics to defeat American armor. He came up with ingenious, low-tech ways to build and employ explosively formed penetrator weapons, a normally high-tech device that shapes metal projectiles by the blast of the explosive, sending them through steel like a knife through butter. He destroyed his first American tank in 2005. And by 2007, a year in which 33,900 IED attacks took place against coalition forces in Iraq, Zarif had trained hundreds of bomb makers in his tactics. He was moved to Afghanistan in 2011 by Hezbollah, and there he built his largest IED. He wired a 2,000-pound bomb to a detonator and placed it in the back of a water truck. A martyr then drove it into Kandahar and made it to within 100 yards of a British base before he was shot dead by a sniper's bullet. He then let go of the dead man's switch, detonating the device and killing 76, all but five of them local. By the time of the Arab Spring and the civil wars throughout the region, Zarif was in his late 40s, and he was old enough to see he was being used as a tool by different sects, beliefs, tribes, and factions. He decided his only true allegiance was to himself, and he went freelance. The Syrian government snatched him up, both to help their forces build booby traps in the cities they fled in order to escape the FSA, and to take him off the market so that he did not fight against them. The relationship was transactional. He didn't care for the Assad regime any more than he cared for the people he blew to bits with his IEDs. But soon he was with Assad's 17th Division, wiring entire buildings to blow on trip wires and lining roads behind the division's retreat with car bombs. His reputation grew in Syria, and the world's intelligence organizations located him through his actions. Soon it became clear he could not leave Damascus because of all the parties who wanted him dead. Ree's agents met him at his safe house, and they revealed they weren't there to talk about a training trip to North Korea. Instead, they proposed the plan to transport him to Mexico City, link him up with agents of a local group there, and to provide him with all the intelligence and material he needed to kill the U.S. president. After he succeeded, he would then be secreted out of the country by North Korean agents and taken either back to Syria if he wanted, or better yet, to North Korea, where he would live all of the rest of his days feeling the warmth of a grateful nation. The agents showed him pictures on their tablet computer of his future home, a palace on the beaches near the city of Hamhung, along with photos of beautiful young girls, any of which he could choose as his own to be his wife. Zarif wanted out of Syria, and he saw this Mexico City operation as his best bet. But he did not agree to it outright. He knew his only chance to make it to the beautiful beaches and live like a king in a palace was success in his mission, and the absolute deniability that either he or North Korea had any involvement. He peppered the agents with technical questions, and he demanded to go to North Korea to meet with the leadership there. Ree did not like this, but he saw no choice. Although the Syrian government had all but held their best bomb maker like a prisoner for the past few years, North Korean intelligence officers persuaded Zarif's handlers to give him travel documents to leave the country. The North Koreans said they wanted to bring Zarif to Pyongyang to train their direct action forces in how to make explosively formed penetrator bombs. And while there, North Koreans would in turn give him access to recently acquired high-tech South Korean communications equipment. This knowledge would help him keep up with advances in remote detonators. Working in Syria, he'd had little access to new equipment, and the DPRK convinced the Syrian government that a short trip for Zarif would be in Syria's best interests. The ruse was a lie, of course. Zarif would travel to Mexico. He would kill the President of the United States, and he would then retire to the Oceanside in North Korea. Or so Zarif had been led to believe. Zarif was transported to Pyongyang the next day, where he met with Ri and others, and when he showed reluctance to agree to the plan, he was unsure of the efficiency of the Mexicans and the credibility of their intelligence, he was flown to Hom Hong and shown his future home. The palace existed. It was stately and impressive, and the beautiful girls were lined up at the entryway to meet him. Adil Zarif was sold. In truth, the mansion was one of many properties for use by the Supreme Leader, and General Ri had no plans to call the Dewan Su and tell him he was offering up his home to a foreign Muslim assassin. No. As Adil Zarif smiled and shook Ri's hand on the tarmac in Pyongyang, anxious to leave North Korea to head to Mexico to begin preparations for the biggest operation of his career, the sad hangdog eyes of General Ri brightened for a moment, and he smiled back. The man before him would die during the execution of Operation Fire Axe, and no one in the world would know Zarif had ever been here. Chapter 29. Edward Riley left his BMW i8 parked in a garage on 23rd Street and walked the last 6 blocks to his destination. It was raining this afternoon in Manhattan, but this was good news for Riley because it gave him an excuse to wear his raincoat. He would have worn it anyway for operational reasons, but it would have looked odd in the sun. He'd received a call 5 minutes earlier letting him know his trap had been sprung. He wasn't sure exactly how long he should wait before showing up at the trap, but he knew his best chance for success was to catch his victim at the exact moment of maximum distress, so he did not delay. On 29th near Lexington, he turned off of the sidewalk and walked down a few steps to a basement entrance below a 5-story apartment building. He rapped on the metal door a few times and then closed his umbrella, leaving it against a small table sitting there by the door. The door was opened from the inside a moment later. Riley stepped into a poorly lit narrow hallway, and he nodded to the middle-aged Asian woman standing there. "Room 4," she said, her gravelly voice barely above a whisper. Riley headed up the hall, taking care to avoid touching anything. Not the walls or the doorknobs of the doors he passed. He even made sure his pants leg below his raincoat didn't brush against the curtains covering an alcove on his right. It wasn't that he was trying to avoid leaving fingerprints or DNA at the scene. Instead, he kept his hands tight at his sides and his slacks away from any surface at ankle height because Riley felt this place was utterly filthy. It was a massage parlor, a house of prostitution, and it was in heavy use from what Riley had been told. Riley's men had followed a man to this establishment twice in 3 days. It was clear that his target had a habit, so Riley stopped in to talk to the proprietor, then flashed a badge, a smile, and some cash. He showed the Japanese mama-san in charge a picture of his target, then asked her to tip him off the next time the man showed up. Riley explained how he would conduct a raid, and he told her she'd make $2,000 to reimburse her for the disturbance to her business, and he assured her that her cooperation would mean the New York Police Department would show its gratitude by not interfering with her operation afterward. His promises were only half bullshit. The $2,000 Riley could come up with, but he couldn't do a damn thing about the NYPD. At the door marked 4, he used his elbow, enshrouded in his raincoat, and with it he banged just once. This door, like the other, was opened from the inside, but this time he was greeted by an American, a black man in his 30s, big and strong, with a badge around his neck proclaiming him to be a detective from the NYPD. Riley knew Bridgeforth wasn't a detective. He was an employee of Sharp's Partners and a subordinate of Riley's. But the badge went along with today's ruse. Riley reached into his raincoat around his neck, and he pulled out a similar-looking badge of his own. There was one more person here in room 4 with Riley and Bridgeforth, and the badges were for his benefit. Seated on a wooden massage table was a thin, middle-aged, European-looking male wearing nothing but his underwear. Riley nodded to Bridgeforth, and the African-American left the room, shutting the door behind him. He ignored the one chair in the room. Instead, he stood in front of the door, his raincoat thin protection against the trillions of microbes he pictured swarming in the air around him. The thin man looked at him with panic-stricken eyes. Good, Riley thought. The Englishman could do a spot-on New York accent. He'd practiced it for hundreds of hours in the past year, even going days in character around the city, to the point he never saw any hint of doubt from anyone he came in contact with. He slipped into his character with ease. In his booming Brooklyn voice, he said, "Detective Rich Kincaid, NYPD." And then, "Vice." The man before him just nodded. Then he spoke with a pronounced Austrian accent. "As I mentioned to your colleague, Detective, I have diplomatic immunity from prosecution." Riley shrugged, his hands wide, a gesture in keeping with his character. "Who's prosecuting?" "You are required to..." "You are required to sit there and shut the fuck up!" The Austrian recoiled in surprise. "Now let's figure out where we stand here. You are Hans Tischer. You were with the Austrian delegation to the UN. That means, even though my partner has pictures of you bumping uglies with some teenage hooker right in the middle of America's greatest city, I have to let you go." The man on the massage table did not hide his expression of relief. "But I can hold you here till my friend the photog from the New York Post shows up outside and gets into position." Tischer gasped now.
"Nein! No! Please, you must not do this!"
"Of course, you could always shoot out the back." "Yeah, my work." He affected another half-shrug. "Although I already told my pal from the Daily News that you might try that, so I don't really recommend it."
"Mein Gott! Why are you doing this to me?"
Riley took a step closer. "When your ugly mug is on the front page of the paper, are you going to tell your family that little girl said she was 18? Will they believe you? She's in an ambulance outside, and she don't look 18 to me, Hans." Tischer covered his face with his hands. "I've got to cut you loose, but I don't got to like it. And there's no law that says I've got to do it without walking you by the press. You know what I'm saying?" Tischer sobbed softly. Riley leaned in now, closer and softer. "Or I can make it all go away. No name, no picture, no problem." Tischer looked up, eyes wide in disbelief.
"Yes? How?"
Even softer, Riley said, "This is where it gets interesting, Hans." He looked back over his shoulder to make sure the door was closed. "3 days from now, your committee has a procedural vote." Just as Riley expected, the emotions displayed on the face of the man in front of him ran the gamut, from confusion to outrage to a new concern. After a few moments, he said,
"What is this?"
Riley shrugged, still in character. "It's one guy needin' a favor. That's you. And another guy needin' a favor. That's me.
Who are you? You aren't a policeman.
I'm the guy with the pictures of you in the act. I'm the guy with the friends in the press outside. And I'm the guy who will fucking burn you if you don't vote against the sanctions hearing.
Why?
Riley just said, why? Why does anyone do what they do? Why do you pull your pants down in nasty-ass places like this? It wasn't an answer to the question, but it had the effect of shutting down Tischer's line of questioning. The Austrian man looked down at the floor for a long time. It won't matter. If I vote the way you want me to, it won't matter. There are 9 of us. We took a straw poll yesterday, and the majority are in favor of the Security Council sanctions hearing. The vote on Friday is just a formality. Riley smiled.
You might just find others have changed their position since the last straw poll. The world is coming to its senses on the matter.
Tischer realized what this man was saying. He'd gotten to others on the committee. The middle-aged Austrian did not doubt this for a second. He said,
I tell you I will vote no, and you will let me go without anyone seeing me?
Yes. I go out and tell my buddy from the post I was wrong. You weren't here. He and I hit the road. 5 minutes later, you walk on out and go back to your life like nothing happened. You vote no on Friday, and you'll get an envelope with the disc with all the images my colleague took. You destroy that, and this whole little escapade is behind you.
Tischer said, you can't possibly work for North Korea. Can you?
Of course not. I'm NYPD. Along with this, let's just say I moonlight for an interested party. We'll leave it there.
Tischer nodded slowly. Okay. Let us leave it there.
Riley smiled.
Chapter 30. John Clark, Ding Chavez, and Sam Driscoll had been in the city for 5 days before they managed to tail Sharp's employee Edward Riley to the massage parlor on 29th Street. Driscoll had the eye when Riley went in, but then he continued on, walking under his umbrella up the street a few hundred yards, bought a gyro from a vendor on 3rd Avenue, and then stepped inside a covered bus stop to shield himself from the rain while he ate it. He was just within sight of the building Riley had entered, but he'd be useful only if he pulled his camera and its zoom lens from his backpack. For now, however, he enjoyed his gyro, because he'd handed the eye off to Chavez. Domingo Chavez approached from the other direction. He wore a suit and tie and talked into a mobile phone. He stopped inside a Duane Reade drugstore across the street from Riley's destination, and he began looking at umbrellas at a stand. From his vantage point here, he had a perfect view of the entrance to the building, less than 30 yards away. His conversation into his phone continued. It was Clark at the other end, and he was back at the safe house, sitting in front of a computer and watching his men's movements on a computerized map. Their banter was inane cover material about the perfect weather back home in L.A. as compared with here in New York. When Ding stopped in the pharmacy, Clark saw this on his map, and when Ding said, in a hushed voice, across the street from my post, basement entrance, Clark began scanning the area on map of the world for information. It took just seconds to realize the location was a massage parlor. There were links to a web page with a phone number and an offer of Asian massage that, without coming right out and offering sex for money, certainly implied as much by filling the web page full of young Asian women in lingerie. Clark was pretty sure this wasn't the kind of place you got a referral from your doc to visit if you needed help treating a chronic sports injury. He relayed his findings to Ding, who by then had begun browsing through other parts of the pharmacy. Ding made no reply. He just continued talking about the weather and glancing through the glass at the front of the room. Riley left the building after just 10 minutes, and on a hunch, Sam stuck around while Ding trailed the target back in the direction of his car. 5 minutes after this, a nervous-looking middle-aged man in dress slacks and an open-collared dress shirt came up the steps from the exit of the building. Sam finished his gyro and reached into his backpack, from where he retrieved a Nikon with a 300mm lens, and even as he snapped off a dozen pictures of the man's face, he had a feeling he knew who he was. The man stood in the rain as if he were unaware of it while he hailed a taxi. Sam slipped his camera into his bag and headed back to the safe house. Sharp's Global Intelligence Partners corporate HQ was on the Upper West Side, so the campus had secured a safe house nearby in a 16th-floor condo on West 79th Street. It was a simple 3-bedroom, 2,000-square-foot property, and the safe house itself gave the team no direct overwatch of any part of Sharp's operation. But this wasn't a normal surveillance. Their intentions had been simply to find any of Sharp's operatives in the field and track their movements and their contacts. Their mission to prove Sharp's was working with North Korea had taken on even more significance when Jerry called the team the day before and had them assemble for a conference call. Jerry had started the conference by saying, "I'm sure you all have seen the news that there's going to be a procedural vote in the UN Security Council Sanctions Committee next week on the North Korean situation. 9 UN bureaucrats will decide if the request from the Ryan White House meets the arcane conditions to go before a full Security Council vote. Needless to say, the U.S. government needs this procedural vote to pass. Without it, the conduits to North Korea's trade remain in place, and they get closer and closer to buying the material and expertise